At 11:17 a.m., we'll go back on record.
Mr. Peterson, it's Bob Hinckley again. You talked about a final report and a tie-out with the seller going up to your people in New York. I think you called them the collateral people. And then they would advise the trade desk and execute the trade. Did I get that right?
Well, in addition to that final tie-out report, Clayton would provide a set of reports to our business unit as well. And then the collateral analysis team would use that information along with all the other data and reports that were coming in from the other processes and provide that information to the trade desk to finalize the trade, yes.
Okay. Who was in charge of collateral that you sent these reports to?
That was Chris Gilley.
How do you spell Chris's last name?
G-I-L-L-Y. Her first name is spelled K-R-I-S.
I should have asked that too. How regularly did you interface with Ms. Gilley? Besides sending her reports, of course.
We would communicate by email or phone several times per month. It was typically her team who would send us the diligence sample for the trades, and we would send reports back to them as well during the process.
Did there ever become a problem between her group and your group in terms of too many due diligence issues or anything like that?
No.
No. Tell me, we talked about Clayton having their report ones, twos, two W's, and threes. What, at the end of the day, was the typical level of threes in a sample? Can you tell me? What is the percentage of the sample?
Percentage of the... Just to make sure I understand the question, are you asking what percentage of the sample wound up as a three at the end of the process?
Yes.
I don't have a good recollection or a guess on that. I would want to go back and look at specific records.
So you couldn't tell me that it was between 0 and 10%, between 10 and 20%, over 30%?
I wouldn't want to hazard a guess.
What are you doing now at Saxon?
I manage due diligence.
And in the course of the 4 years you were doing it, or 2005-2007, you wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to what the typical reject rate was?
No. I'd want to go back and look at records.
Did it ever come to your attention maybe that a particular sample had a very high reject rate as opposed to a very low reject rate?
I don't recall any extremes like that. There was variance amongst pools and product types.
But essentially they were all average.
I think there was some variance. I don't recall it ever being zero.
Right.
I don't recall any extremes. I don't recall what the averages were.
Okay. Did it ever occur that you had a pool that had an extraordinary... Well, you said you don't recall extremes. So you never had a situation where you had an extraordinary number of rejects and you said, maybe we ought to take a better look at this pool?
No, I don't recall that occurring.
Okay. And so essentially, once you sent your report to Ms. Gilley, it was out of your hands and you didn't hear about this pool anymore.
Correct. There may have been occasions where they had some questions regarding data, Chris Gilley's team, after they had received final reports, and we would answer any questions they may have had. But when those final reports were submitted, that was the end of our diligence process.
All right. Fair enough. Could I ask you a little bit about how you were compensated?
I received a base salary plus a bonus at the end of the year.
And how big was the bonus in relation to the base salary? Usually.
Varied.
Yeah.
To my recollection, the range over those few years that you've been asking about was anywhere from 25 to 100%.
And what was your base salary?
To the best of my recollection, when I first started at Morgan Stanley, my base salary was around 105 or 110.
Yep.
And at the end of that time period, I believe it was around 130 or 135. I don't remember for sure.
All right. Thank you. And the people at Equinox, is it true that you guys did you pay them directly, or did you pay Equinox and Equinox paid them?
My understanding is Equinox paid them and invoiced Morgan Stanley for that cost.
Okay, fair enough. And I just want to confirm, when the report went off to Chris Gilley, it would include ones, twos, two W's, and threes. It wasn't a case of between, at your level, loans were rejected and kicked out of the pool.
Well, I'm a little confused on the last part of that question. The best answer I can give is that when we sent the reports and when Clayton sent their final reporting package, it contained the results on all of the loans in the sample. So that would include ones, twos, two W's, and threes.
Okay, okay. And then it was for the people in New York, Ms. Gilley and one of the people on the trading desk you mentioned, to determine what happened to the loans that were threes. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not aware of whether or not Chris Gilley had any involvement in that.
My understanding
is her team took our data and took data from the other sources, put it all together, and then gave that to the trade desk.
And then the trade desk made the decision.
That's my understanding, yes.
All right, that's good. Thank you. Vic, do you have something?
I was just going to ask about, I know we asked you about Ms. Gilley having any feedback for you. Any feedback from the trade desk, complaints about underwriting or underwriters, roadblocks to the seller, any complaints from sellers?
I don't recall any complaints about underwriting or roadblocks. I generally recall there may be times when a seller asked why so many loans were being declined, and we would provide information to the trade desk to help them understand a little bit beyond just a grade 3 of what the types of exceptions were that existed within the loans.
Okay, and so those complaints were made from the seller to the trade desk and conveyed to you from the trade desk?
Well, again, I don't know if they were complaints or simply the trade desk wanting to understand what was behind the numbers.
That's fine, however we characterize it, but the questions were sent to the trade desk and conveyed to you from the trade desk?
Again, I don't know if questions were sent to the trade desk or the trade desk was asking on their own regarding what was behind the numbers.
Okay, so you're not sure whether they came from the seller or whether the trade desk was potentially asking for feedback on reject rates or threes or two W's or that sort of thing.
Correct.
Okay. When they asked, what was the nature of the discussion?
To my recollection, they inquired what, you know, asking for more detail behind the level three findings, because the three doesn't really tell you much about a loan. And so they wanted to understand with a little better detail what were the categories or varieties or types of exceptions that existed within those level three findings. And so we would do some research and provide them information regarding the types of exceptions that existed within the loans. Just keep in mind, as we've discussed, our process involved a credit re-underwrite and a compliance review, and so there could be credit threes and there could be compliance threes as well.
Okay, now I understand your the information you've given us so far, that there is a tie-out report at the end, that there are a number of like aggregating reports that Clayton provides that would seem to summarize a lot of that information. They wanted that real time prior to the closeout?
That information was provided prior to the closing of the trade, yes.
Okay.
Go ahead. This is Tom Borges. I have some questions to follow up also. Did you ever do any due diligence for the warehouse lines that Morgan Stanley was providing?
To my recollection, I was asked to oversee the warehouse diligence team for a very brief period of time towards the end of the warehouse business.
Could you just tell us what type of due diligence you did for the warehouse, Lundy?
The process was similar, where a sample of the loans that were on the warehouse line would be selected and would be reviewed for a credit and compliance re-underwrite.
And do you recall what facilities you were reviewing those for? What originators?
I do not. That was a very, very brief period of time. I think less than 3 months during that time period.
Who did it before you on the warehouse lending?
To the best of my memory, I think for a period of time, Pamela Barrow directly oversaw that. I don't remember much beyond that.
I just want to also ask you about the other types of activities that Clayton performed for Morgan Stanley. Did they do any putback analysis activities for Morgan Stanley?
I'm not sure. It's possible, but I wasn't directly involved in the repurchase department. So they may have used vendors, but I'm not sure.
Have you ever been involved in any aspect of the putback or repurchase side of the activities?
Not in relation to the subprime or the bulk Alt-A business, no.
But in what relationship to other types of activities?
I've had some involvement in recent years in relation to our distressed asset business.
And what type of distressed assets are you talking about?
Residential mortgage loans that are currently being traded in the secondary market, sometimes referred to as scratch and dent.
However, wouldn't these scratch and dents also be subprime and Alt-A?
Scratch and dent can come from a variety of products, but what I was speaking to in response earlier was during that time of 2005 to 2007, when we were active in the subprime and Alt-A first cut origination business, I was not involved in the repurchase process.
But you were involved in the repurchase on the scratch and dent?
More recently, not at that time.
And by more recently, what do you mean by more recently?
I mean over the last 2 years up until about 6 months ago.
So roughly 2008, that's when you started to be involved in the scratch and dent?
In the repurchase process with scratch and dent, yes.
And these were Morgan Stanley scratch and dent deals?
Correct, loans that we had purchased.
And were these scratch and dent deals related to fallout loans from other issuance of Morgan Stanley?
I'm not aware of that to be the case.
So these do you have any knowledge about where these scratch and dent deals came from?
When we say scratch and dent deals, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. I'm not sure who's asking the question even, but what do you, when you say scratch and dent deal, what do you have in mind?
Well, let's ask Mr. Peterson, what scratch and dent loans did you look at? Were they individual scratch and dent deals, or were they something else?
What I'm referring to is our ongoing business of buying pools of loans from various sellers and originators, and they are scratch and dent loans for a variety of reasons, and they come from a variety of sources.
So there were whole loan purchases as opposed to deals?
Right, I'm speaking to whole loan purchases. That's what I've been speaking to all along.
And what type of, do you have any idea what the putback was on the scratch and dent deals that you were seeing during your time from 2008 to 2009 or so?
Oh, there was a variety of issues that may come up in relation to a loan. Sometimes in the scratch and dent business, we might buy a pool of loans, and there may be certain documentation deficiencies that the seller believes they can cure. And so we put those on a side letter, and the seller has a certain period of time to cure those, provide those documents, and if they don't, they have to repurchase the loans. In some instances, we buy non-performing loans that are already delinquent. And if something comes up as we're servicing the loan where there's a defect with the loan that we weren't aware of, or the borrower has litigation going that based on whatever reps and warranties are in the purchase contract, we might have a right to put that loan back to the seller. And so part of the process of the business is it has a group of people who reviews these exceptions that come up and determine, do we have a rep and warrant that covers this, and can we put the loan back to the seller?
And just one final question on the scratch and dent. So do you recall approximately how much in putbacks were you involved with the scratch and dents?
No, it was fairly minimal over that year and a half period that I was involved with it.
Okay. Getting back to your due diligence, the period of time that you had for due diligence, I believe you said it was like approximately 4 or 5 weeks?
Normally 2 to 3 weeks.
2 to 3. Were there anything, any deals less than 2 weeks?
Not that I can recall in the subprime space.
So there was no deals less than 2 weeks that needed to be developed quickly?
Not that I can recall, no.
Yeah, this is Tom Krebs. I want to go back to a couple of things. Again, I'm looking at the Clayton trending report, and I'm looking at the Clayton overall report from the first quarter of 2006 to the second quarter of 2007. Recall when I asked you whether or not 62,940 loans was about right for the number you said it sounds about right, but you're not sure. Am I recalling that correctly?
I do remember that part of the discussion, yes.
Well, according to that same report, it looks as if, but it says that there were 23,154 of the 62,940 loans that were event threes or rejects. Now, you've already explained to us that one of the explanations for that is that over top of the underwriting standards that Morgan Stanley may have superimposed its own more stringent requirements. Is that correct?
Additional requirements beyond the guidelines, yes.
Okay. But does 36% of the total loans reviewed having been rejected, does that sound about right to you?
As I said before, that could be. I don't have a good recollection on that. I would want to go back and look at our records.
Yeah, to the extent that you have records with respect to Clayton trending reports, we request that you provide them to us, if you don't mind, Ro.
Okay, we'll look at that.
All right, the other question I have, and I'm not really sure of this, so forgive me if I'm replowing old ground. When was Clayton informed that the loans noted ranked as event threes or rejects had been made, were made into two W's?
That process occurred actually within their system. When our folks were on site with them, we had access as a client to view information in their system in a place within their system where we could assign the grade of 2W.
Okay.
So that occurred real time as our team was reviewing the files.
Right. What was a 2T ranking?
That would indicate an exception that would be put on a side letter agreement.
Can you explain that to me, please?
A side letter agreement is a situation where a particular exception, and typically it would be a missing document, would be identified as an exception within the loan, and the seller was comfortable that they could cure that exception within a reasonable time period, just not before the trade closed. And so the buyer and the seller would agree to put that exception onto a side letter that, as I understand it, would actually be a list or a schedule that would be attached to the purchase contract that would identify the loan or loans and what the specific exception was that had to be cured. And that seller would have a defined period of time after the trade closed to produce that document. And if they were unable to, then they would be required to repurchase the loan.
You had previously testified here, or stated here today, that you have that you did give testimony in the Massachusetts Attorney General's inquiry. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Did you review the Massachusetts Attorney General's settlement agreement with Morgan Stanley?
I have not, no.
So you don't have an opinion as to whether or not that's accurate?
Accurate in what way?
If you haven't read it, you don't know anything.
He said he hasn't read it.
Yeah. All right. Any more?
I have just a few more questions, Mr. Peterson. We've concentrated on the period 2005 to 2007. As we all know, in 2008, the securitization market went south. Was there any question within Morgan Stanley as to whether or not their due diligence procedures were accurate? Were you ever questioned about them?
I don't recall any question regarding the accuracy of diligence, no.
Did it come to your attention that senior management was interested in the due diligence system and whether or not that was adequate?
No, not that I can recall.
So as far as you can tell, has there been any change in Morgan Stanley's mortgage-backed due diligence since those times?
Well, our diligence process for our ScratchNet business is very similar to the diligence process that we had in place at that time for the subprime and the Alt-A bulk business.
And all you have now is scratch and dent business? Is that what you're saying?
Right. For the last couple of years, to my knowledge, at least in the diligence project that I've worked on, have only been the scratch and dent or distressed asset trades.
And there's nobody else at Morgan Stanley filling your old role?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you notice a deterioration in underwriting standards from your sellers over time? In other words, did they become more flexible or loose?
We did observe a decline in credit quality in early 2006.
And how did you observe that?
By the results that we were seeing in the samples of loans that were going through the diligence process.
So are you saying that there was a decrease in FICO scores, or that your sellers, originators, weren't doing as good a job in terms of underwriting? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I don't call anything one specific characteristic such as FICO scores, but I generally recall that we started to see a greater number of loans with exceptions. In some cases, it might be guideline exceptions, or in other cases, it might be some of the additional risk criteria that we asked Clayton to watch for in addition to the guidelines.
Okay, but I think you testified earlier, didn't you, that you didn't remember what the typical reject rate was.
Right. I don't have a recollection of averages or lows and highs of final reject rates.
But you know reject rates went up over time?
I do recall in early 06 that our credit and compliance reject rate increased at our subprime on our subprime reviews.
And did that result in any concern communication from Ms. Gilley or the traders?
I don't recall any communication with Chris Gilley about that. I do recall in that time frame providing some greater detail to the business unit and the trade desk regarding the types of exceptions that we were seeing.
And enlighten me as to what that was.
Well, it was a variety of issues. To my recollection, it wasn't anything really new or different. It was just the same types of exceptions, but in some increased quantities.
And do you have any indication of what was done with that information once you discussed it with the desk?
To my recollection, one of the areas where we saw some increased risk was with first-time home buyers, and it's my general recollection that the sampling process was adjusted at that point to include that category in the adverse sampling process.
Did you get any indication from Ms. Gilley or otherwise as to how much of the sample was adverse and how much was random?
No, not that I can remember.
Tom, do you have
I'm again referring to the Clayton trending report that was sent by Clayton to Morgan Stanley for the period. The analysis covers the period the second quarter of 06 through the fourth quarter of 06. And it says that with respect to the exception description, he says the value used by the lender was not supported in 1,296 occasions. Notwithstanding that number that was waived, that is to say the final waiver, notwithstanding the fact that the value was not used by the lender wasn't supported, 1,180 were approved or were waived in for a 91% waiver rate. Additionally, cash reserves less than required, 1,442, of which number 1,109 were waived in or accepted by Morgan Stanley. Do you have any recollection of those numbers?
I don't remember those numbers specifically, but I'd like to speak to the category of the value exceptions, if I may.
Oh, by all means, please.
Just to help your understanding of our process, when Clayton was going through the credit re-underwrite, one of the documents they looked at was the appraisal, and if the Clayton reviewer found information in the appraisal that raised a concern to them regarding is the appraisal accurate, or is there maybe indication of a property condition issue, Clayton would flag that as a level 3 finding and bring that to our attention. Our team would forward that information to our value team. I spoke earlier to my understanding of their process running concurrently. We would share information regarding Clayton's findings so they could factor that into their valuation review process. And since the value team was going to include that in make a determination on that loan in the valuation review, we would then downgrade that to a 2W on the credit side and let that be resolved through the valuation review process.
And presumably the valuation review process found that the value used by the lender was somehow supported.
Well, either it was or it wasn't. I couldn't tell you which way they decided on those loans.
And cash reserves less than required, 1,442. And final waive-ins were 1,109. Sorry. How did you handle cash reserves less than required?
It would be on a case-by-case basis. Our people who would look at those exceptions would review the file, look at the extent of the exception, look at other characteristics of the loan, and make a determination about whether or not that was an acceptable risk. What I can't tell from that data is how much below the required amount did those loans have? You know, what was the extent of the exception?
There's one here about which I'm very curious. It's an entry in the same exception description, and it says loan characteristics do not match any available program, 1,954 of which 1,085 were waived in or were accepted by Morgan Stanley. What does that mean, loan characteristics do not match any available program?
I would have to look at the individual loans to give a good answer on that, because it would depend on the individual characteristics of that loan as it was compared to the lender's underwriting guidelines.
So, I mean, do I understand it to mean that there was no comparable underwriting guideline for that loan? I'm not sure I understand the loan characteristics do not match any available program as a general category.
The best answer I can give as a general category is that would indicate that there's some feature within the loan that the guideline program that they're looking at does not account for.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
This is Tom Borges. Mr. Peterson, how often did you receive a copy and review the trending reports?
Again, I don't recall specific dates or frequencies of trending reports.
Have you ever seen one?
I generally recall having seen some trending reports. I think I've looked at some that were very recently provided to your committee.
Okay, and also, right now you're doing due diligence for Morgan Stanley in the Saxon group. How many people report to you right now?
Right now I have two direct reports.
And how many deals are you doing now over the last couple of years?
In some months, none, and in some months, maybe one or two or three.
So you have three people doing one or two deals a month?
That's correct.
I don't have any further questions.
No, none. Mr. Peterson, this is Tom Krebs. Thank you so very much. We very much appreciate your cooperation. Raul, let's talk a little bit later this afternoon. I have an interview right after this one, and we'll talk about catching up with documents.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
very
you.
Much appreciate it.
Great.
And ladies.
Thank you all.
Thank you. All right, 11:50, we'll go off record.
This is